This last item, number five. Did you tell them what to look for? That it would have been a hair-related item?
Yes. What else would they be looking for?
He ping-ponged back to another wall. He pointed to the printed emails from the Love to See Murder domain.
This is a list of what serial killers do. Number one, they take trophies. That's what Becky's attacker is doing. He stalks them, he takes something from them, then he attacks them and makes it look like an accident.
Wait, Faith said. What do you mean, stalk?
Weeks before they died, every single one of these women told a family member or friend or co-worker that they felt strange, as if someone was watching them.
Faith considered this new information. She could think of many explanations, not least of all that being a woman in the world made you feel vulnerable sometimes. That's not on your list of questions, to ask them about a feeling of being watched.
I know enough that you always hold something back. I let them tell me.
They just told you?
I was careful.
He pointed to the Love to See Murder emails.
This guy's a retired police detective. One of the rare good ones. He's been helping me investigate. He said that the biggest mistake women make is not listening to their instincts.
Faith scanned the emails. Dee Masterson had been corresponding with Gerald for at least 2 years. She saw PDFs for invoices. You mentioned earlier that you paid a private investigator. Is this him?
No, I was talking about Chip Shepherd. I worked with him 5 years ago. He's another retired cop. I paid him for 3 months. He worked for six. His case files are here.
He kicked the stack of boxes.
Chip came up with nothing. They always come up with nothing. For 5 years, I've worked every bone in my body to keep the case alive. The business is good, but it's not enough. My savings are depleted. I have no retirement. The house is mortgaged. The money from the lawsuits is in a trust to take care of Becky. Every part of my life goes toward taking care of her and Heath. And whatever is left over, I do this.
Faith let out a long breath. The room felt claustrophobic. It was about to get smaller. Faith thought she had figured out the answer to the question that Will had been asking since they'd tossed around theories in the prison chapel this morning. She started out gently. Mr. Catarino, why did you send Daryl Nesbitt those newspaper articles? There was no note, no letter, just the articles.
Because...
He caught himself a second too late.
He still insists he's innocent. I wanted him to feel as trapped, as helpless as I do.
Faith believed that he was trying to torture Daryl Nesbitt, but there was more to the story. I'm sorry to ask this, but why are you so certain that Daryl Nesbitt isn't the man who hurt your daughter?
I never said...
Mr. Catarino, 5 years ago, you spent good money on lawyers to pay for Daryl Nesbitt's civil suit against Jeffrey Tolliver's estate. Gerald's face registered surprise. She said, a lot of times, civil cases are used to get police officers on the record so that the evidence can later be used against them in criminal proceedings. His lips closed into a tight line. 5 years ago, you started Becky's Facebook page and website, Faith continued. For the last 5 years, you've been collecting articles about missing women you think linked back to your daughter's attack.
These other women.
No. Faith stopped him again. You started your investigation 5 years ago. Some of these cases go back 8 years. What made you believe 5 years ago that Daryl Nesbitt wasn't the man who attacked Becky? There had to be a compelling reason. Gerald bit his lip to keep it from quivering. He couldn't stop the tears when they returned. Faith slowly walked him through it. You post about a lot of things, Mr. Catarino, but you never post about your son. He wiped his eyes.
Heath understands that Becky has to be the focus.
Faith didn't let up. I've noticed all the cameras you've got around the house, inside and out. Is this a dangerous area, Mr. Catarino?
The world is a dangerous place.
This seems like a very safe neighborhood. Faith paused. It makes me wonder what you're protecting. He shrugged defensively.
It's not against the law to have security cameras and a gate.
It's not, Faith agreed. But I wanted to tell you how impressed I am with your little boy. He's really smart. He's hitting a lot of benchmarks ahead of time. Has your pediatrician told you that? He's almost like an 8-year-old.
He'll be 7 at Christmas.
Right, she said. His birthday is about 39 weeks after Becky was attacked. Gerald could only hold her gaze for a few seconds before he looked down at the floor. Here's what I think, Faith said. I think that 5 years ago, Daryl Nesbitt wrote to you from prison. The muscles along Gerald's throat tightened. I think you saw that letter, and you realized that Daryl Nesbitt licked the flap to seal the envelope. His saliva was on the back of the stamp. Faith tried to be as gentle as she could. Did you test Daryl Nesbitt's DNA from the envelope, Mr. Catarino? Gerald kept his head bent, his chin touching his chest. Tears splattered onto the carpet. You know what would scare me, Mr. Catarino? What would make me put up security cameras and gates and fences and sleep with a gun by my bed? He took in a deep breath, but still kept his eyes on the floor. The thing that would keep me up at night, Faith said, was worrying that the man who attacked my daughter would find out that 9 months later, she gave birth to his son. Chapter 9. Sarah looked at the clock on the stove. 7:42 p.m. Time had slipped away from her while she was taking care of Alexandra McAllister. First, there were the logistics of getting Ezra Engel to change the official cause of death. Then Amanda had started working with the sheriff's office to put through the formal request to allow the GBI to take over. Next, Sarah had to transport the body to GBI headquarters so she could perform the autopsy. Then she was dictating her report and signing off on all the evidence in lab orders and forensics. Then a junior medical examiner had asked her to review the autopsy records on Jesus Vasquez, the murdered inmate from the prison riot. Then Sarah had sat at her desk for God only knew how long, trying to bring some clarity to her endlessly troubling day. Sarah hadn't registered how late it was until she'd walked out of the building and looked up into the black, moonless sky. She stood up from the kitchen bar stool. The dogs looked up from the couch as she started to pace. Sarah felt useless. Tessa was on her way from Grant County with Jeffrey's files. She'd hit the tail end of rush hour traffic. There was nothing Sarah could do right now but wait. The dogs had been fed and walked. She'd straightened up the apartment. She had fixed herself a dinner that she could barely eat. She had turned on the TV, then turned it off. She had done the same with the radio. She was so antsy that her skin itched. She scooped her phone off the counter. She reread her last text to Will. A telephone with a question mark. Then a dinner plate with a question mark. Then a single question mark. He had not written back. Sarah told herself the obvious. Will had lost track of time, too. They were handling a murder now. Possibly multiple murders. Lena had probably flipped everything upside down, the way that Lena always did. Sarah shouldn't read too much into his silence. Nor should she read anything into the fact that Will had obviously turned off his phone. Sarah had tapped the Find My app half a dozen times, trying to locate him on the app. And each time, all she'd gotten was Lena's address and the number of minutes, then hours, that had passed since Will had been there. Sarah heard a banging at the door.
Sissy?
Tessa's knock sounded more like a kick.
Hurry up!
Sarah found Tessa juggling 3 file boxes. She'd left shoe scuffs on the bottom of the door.
Don't help. I've got it.
Tessa dumped everything onto the dining room table. Thankfully, Jeffrey had strapped down the lids.
You wouldn't believe that traffic. I got a blister on my palm from pounding on the horn. And now I'm dying of thirst.
Sarah gathered from her tone that she didn't want water. She hesitated before opening the bottom cabinet. Will had a thing about Sarah drinking, as if one glass of Merlot was going to turn her into Judy Garland.
Scotch.
Tessa reached past her and grabbed the bottle.
Pour me a small one, like what you give to a baby. I've got to drive back tonight. What's with the paper towel?
Don't ask.
Will dried paper towels to reuse them, because her smart, sexy boyfriend had apparently grown up during the Depression.
Why do you have to drive back tonight? I've got a 9 a.m. interview with that midwife I told you about. She's taking on an intern. Fingers crossed it turns out to be me.
Tessa found two glasses in the cabinet.
Lemuel called right when I was hitting downtown, like I wasn't murdery enough from traffic.
Sarah poured the drinks. She gave herself a double. Tessa's husband was still in South Africa with their daughter.
How's Izzy? Amazing as always.
Tessa sipped from the glass.
Lem got the divorce papers. He's taking it better than I thought he would.
Sarah led her back to the table so they could sit down.
Did you want him to take it badly? I'm just tired.
She slumped into a chair beside Sarah.
It's exhausting being married when you don't want to be married. And he's such a pompous ass sometimes.
Sarah quietly objected to the sometimes.
I know you never saw what I saw in him, Tessa said. Let's just say he's like Taco Bell. You've got to pay for the extra meat.
Sarah raised her glass in a toast.
Where's Will?
Working. Sarah let herself look at the boxes. Jeffrey's boxes. His familiar script flowed across the labels. She wanted to reach out and touch the words.
Will asked me to marry him.
Tessa coughed on her drink. Sarah confessed.
6 weeks ago. You've talked to me how many times since then?
Sarah talked to her sister at least once a day, sometimes more. But she'd never talked about this.
Do you think it didn't work out with Jeffrey the first time because I didn't pay enough attention to him? I'm not even sure what that means. It means I was always at Mom and Dad's or doing something with you or... Marriage isn't Rumspringa. You don't have to leave your family.
She put down her glass and held Sarah's hand.
Sissy, remember I was there? I'm the one who followed his sorry ass around town and broke into his computer and bribed motel clerks because you were going crazy from all of the bullshit lies about how it was just one woman, hardly more than that one time, when we both knew it was more like 5 women and 50 different times.
Sarah remembered the feeling of disconnection between what Jeffrey repeatedly promised her and how he behaved. But for Tess playing detective, she probably would have never learned the truth. She told her sister,
I know. Jeffrey cheated because all he could think about was what he was missing, not what he had.
She squeezed Sarah's hand.
He changed for you. He worked really hard to be the kind of man you deserved. The first time was hell on earth, but it made the second time that much sweeter.
Sarah nodded because everything she said was the truth.
When Will asked me, he didn't really ask me. But in his defense, it was a strange conversation. I started talking about remodeling his house, putting on a second floor. That's a great idea. You could do everything exactly the way you want. That's what I told him, Sarah said. And then Will said, we should get married in a church. It'll make your mother happy. What the hell does Mama have to do with it?
Tess scowled.
Does he want Daddy to play Lohengrin on the piccolo?
Sarah shook her head.
I don't know what he wants. So that's the real problem. You're not talking to him about something that's really important. You're pretending it didn't happen.
Sarah didn't know what she was doing anymore.
I don't want to be the one who has to bring it up. I'm always the one pushing things. I want Will to push back for once. But then I think maybe he's changed his mind. Maybe he feels like he dodged a bullet.
That's bullshit. You know how he feels about you.
Tessa finished her drink.
You're not bringing it up because you don't want to talk about it, which is fine. But do him the courtesy of letting him know you're not ready.
I want him to do me the courtesy.
Spit in one hand, want in the other. See which fills up the fastest.
This was why Sarah hadn't brought up the subject before.
Not that this has anything to do with Will, or how you feel about him, or why you're not talking to him about getting married. But I can help you sort through Jeffrey's stuff if you want,
Tessa offered. No, go home and get some rest. Sarah finally reached out and touched one of the boxes. She felt a warmth spread through her fingers. I'm going to be reading all night.
Four eyes are faster than two.
It's a lot of jargon, technical stuff.
I can read technical stuff.
Sarah caught her sharp tone too late.
Tessie, I know you can. I'm not Amelia Bedelia. I understand jargon. I know basic anatomy. I've been reading a lot of blogs on midwifery.
Sarah tried to hide her laughter in a cough.
Are you laughing at me?
Sarah stifled another laugh.
Jesus H. Christ.
Tessa pushed her chair back from the table.
I have to listen to this bullshit from Lemuel. I'm not taking it off you.
I'm sorry, Tess. Sarah laughed again.
I didn't. I'm sorry. Please don't.
It was too late. Tessa slammed the door behind her. Another laugh slipped out of Sarah's mouth. Then she felt the sinking guilt that came from being an inexcusable asshole. She should have gotten up and followed her sister into the hall, but her legs wouldn't move. She looked back at the boxes, three in all. Jeffrey had labeled them 8 years ago, before he was back with Sarah, before they had rebuilt their lives together, before she had watched the life slowly drain from his beautiful eyes. Rebecca Catarino, box one of one. Leslie Truong, box one of one. Thomasina Humphrey, box one of one. Sarah found a pair of scissors in the kitchen. She carried the bottle of scotch back to the table. She found the remote and turned on some soft music. She had a legal pad and pen in her briefcase. She sat down at the table. She cut open the first box. Was there a smell attached to the pages? Jeffrey had used oatmeal lotion on his hands when he thought no one was looking. He didn't wear a cologne, but his aftershave had a wonderful woodsy scent. Sarah could remember the rough feel of his skin at night, the soft touch of his fingers tracing slowly down her body. She closed her eyes, trying to summon the deep baritone that had thrilled her, then infuriated her, then made her fall in love with him all over again. Was this cheating? Were her memories of Jeffrey betraying Will? Sarah put her head in her hands. She had started to cry. She wiped her eyes. She poured herself a drink. She pulled the first stack of pages out of the box and started to read. Grant County, Wednesday, Chapter 10. Jeffrey studied the contents of Rebecca Catarino's case file. The paperwork on the accident in the woods covered his desk. Witness statements from her doormates, Lena and Brad's reports, Frank's summary, Jeffrey's own recollections, photos from Lena's BlackBerry, Sarah's notes on the resuscitation, some scrawled preliminary lines from Dan Brock, who was still officially the coroner on the case, even though a coroner wasn't needed. Not yet, at least. He closed the file and dropped it in the cardboard box behind his desk. The label read general, but Jeffrey didn't feel right about filing the girl away. Actually, his didn't feel right had turned into a straight up felt wrong. He wasn't quite sure what had tipped him over the line. Maybe the fact that the only person who might be able to fill in some details about the accident was currently missing. Leslie Truong had left the Caterino crime scene around 6 yesterday morning. The 1.5-mile trek back to campus would have taken her 20, maybe 30 minutes. The rainstorm had rushed in around that same time. Jeffrey told himself that Truong had taken cover under a tree or slipped in the woods. A twisted ankle, a broken bone. That was the only reason she hadn't made it to the nurse's office. She was waiting for someone to find her. Half of his patrol force and several volunteers from the college had spent the night trying to locate the missing woman in the woods. Jeffrey had participated in his share of grueling searches for missing teenagers, but this was different. Truong was an older student, a senior, who was close to graduating with a major in chemical polymers. When the woods hadn't panned out, Jeffrey had driven to her off-campus apartment. Truong's blue Toyota Prius had been found parked in the lot behind her building. Her purse was locked inside her bedroom. The three students who shared rooms there had no idea where she was. The list of friends that they gave him had all been dead ends. Truong had taken her phone with her into the woods, the same phone she'd used to call 911 to report finding Caterino. The battery had died, or maybe the phone had gotten wet. No calls could get through. According to Lena's official report, Truong had been upset about discovering Caterino, but not so much that she'd needed an escort to see the school nurse. Lena had offered to find her a ride. Truong had said she preferred to walk back to campus. Of course, that was according to Lena. Jeffrey still had men in the woods, trying to take advantage of the fresh daylight. The biggest obstacle was that they had no idea which path Truong had taken. There were several options winding through the dense forest, and that was making the assumption that Truong followed a path. It was possible she'd run through the tangle of vines and briars, because she had just seen a body, and she was desperate to reach a safe, familiar setting. He let himself think about her waiting under a tree. It was possible someone was finding her right now. Or it was possible none of that was true, and someone had taken her. Jeffrey's thoughts kept swinging along the same pendulum as they had with Rebecca Caterino. Throughout the night, Jeffrey had vacillated on the reason behind Truong's disappearance. One minute, he was thinking that she was hiding out somewhere after the trauma of finding the body. The next minute, he was thinking that something bad had happened and the girl had been abducted. He had no idea why a bad thing, any bad thing, would happen to either of them. As with Caterino, Truong was well-liked on campus. Jeffrey had talked to her roommates, her boss at the coffee shop, and her building super, a woman who came across more as a house mother. Bonita Truong, who lived in San Francisco, had not heard from her daughter in days. This was not unusual, a fact that the mother seemed fine with. Jeffrey had to think there were two reasons that a student would go clear across the country to school. Either they were trying to get away from their parents, or their parents had raised the kind of kid who spread her wings on her own. Jeffrey felt strongly that Leslie Truong fell into this latter category. If he had to describe the missing student based on what little information he'd gleaned, he'd say she was level-headed, hard-working, and stable. 4 to 5 days a week, she was up at the crack of dawn, walking 2 miles to the lake to do Tai Chi. Lena had described her as woo-woo, but she definitely didn't come across as the type of girl who disappeared into the night. Then again, Truong had never before found what she assumed was a dead body lying in the woods. What bothered Jeffrey was a stray detail that could mean something or could mean nothing at all. On the phone last night, Bonita Truong had told Jeffrey that her daughter was angry with her roommates. Some of her clothes were missing. Someone had borrowed her favorite headband and hadn't returned it. Apparently, Leslie used the pink band to pull her hair back as she washed her face every night, which was something that Jeffrey was familiar with from living with Sarah. They had often argued about the blue headband she'd left out on the sink basin, an area that offered little space to begin with. Jeffrey had even bought her a basket to store some of her crap in. Sarah had ended up using it to hold dog toys. Jeffrey turned his chair to look out the window. The Z4 wasn't there to taunt him. His watch read just past 6 in the morning. The clinic didn't open until 8. He looked at his calendar. It was the last Wednesday of the month, so Sarah wouldn't be at work anyway. She usually stayed home and plowed through the mountain of paperwork she'd accumulated over the previous month. He looked at his watch again. Bonita Truong's plane from San Francisco would be landing in 3 hours. The drive from Atlanta would take another 2. He needed to rotate out some of the searchers so they could get some sleep. The station was empty, but for Brad Stevens. The young officer had volunteered to babysit the prisoners in the holding cells. Jeffrey imagined if he went back to holding, he would find Brad asleep too. So Jeffrey would not go back into holding. He stood up from his desk and stretched his back. His coffee mug was empty. He walked into the squad room. The lights were still off. He turned them on as he made his way to the kitchen. Ben Walker, Jeffrey's predecessor, had kept his office at the rear of the station, just off the interrogation room. His desk had been the size of a commercial refrigerator, and the seating in front had been about as comfortable as a Judas chair. Every morning, Walker had called Frank and Matt into his office, doled out their daily assignments, then told them to shut the door on their way out. That door only opened at noon, when Walker went to the diner for lunch, and at 5, when he hit the diner on his way home. When Walker had finally retired, the desk had to be cut into 2 pieces to get it through the door. No one could explain how he'd managed to cram it into the room in the first place. There were a lot of unexplained things where Ben Walker was concerned. The desk alone was an object lesson in how not to be a chief. Jeffrey had spent his first weekend on the job, moving his office to the front of the squad room. He cut a hole in the wall to make a window so he could see his team, and more importantly, so they could see him. There were blinds on the glass that he seldom closed. The door stayed open unless someone needed privacy. In a town this small, there was a lot of need for privacy. The phone rang. Jeffrey picked up the receiver on the kitchen wall.
Grant PD. Hey there, buddy, Nick Shelton said. I hear you got some trouble brewing down there.
Jeffrey poured some fresh coffee into his mug.
News travels fast.
I got me a spy at the Macon Hospital.
Jeffrey had heard a definite period at the end of that sentence, but he could tell there was more to it than that.
What's up, Nick?
Gerald Catarino.
Rebecca Catarino's father?
Jeffrey had set the alarm on his phone to call the man at 6:30. He could tell by Nick's tone that he should rethink that plan.
Should I be worried?
Yeah, the old boy left a message on the service last night. I picked it up this morning and thought I could run some interference for you.
Interference?
Jeffrey asked.
I didn't realize I needed any.
It's the timing.
Nick was being careful, but Jeffrey got his meaning. Someone at the hospital had told Gerald Catarino that his daughter was presumed dead when Lena had arrived at the scene. That was a kind of detail that could end up in a lawsuit.
Thanks for the heads up.
No problem, Haas. Let me know if you need anything.
Jeffrey hung up the phone. He felt a headache working its way up his neck. He should have taken his own order and grabbed some sleep. At the very least, he would have been able to process the next steps he needed to take. Make sure everyone was on the same page about yesterday morning in the woods. Reread Frank, Lena, and Brad's notes. Make sure his own notebook lined up with their recollections. Call the mayor to warn him that something bad might be coming down the pipeline. Give Kevin Blake at the university a warning about the hell that was about to rain down. He stared down into the blackness of his coffee. The liquid rippled against the rim.
His body was still holding on to the memory of bones cracking beneath his hands. Rebecca Caterino had spent 30 extra minutes lying on her back in the forest. Jeffrey had thought seconds had passed while Sarah was finding a way to make the girl breathe again, but according to her resuscitation notes, almost 3 minutes had gone by. 33 minutes in total, all on Jeffrey's clock. What he wanted to do was apologize to Gerald Caterino and to Becky. He wanted to tell them exactly what had happened, that people had made mistakes. And some of them were stupid mistakes, but all of them were honest mistakes. Unfortunately, lawyers were not known to settle for apologies.
Chief!
Frank grabbed a mug off the hook.
Anything on Leslie Truong?
No sign of her.
Not surprising.
Frank hacked out a cough.
You know how hysterical these young co-eds get. She's probably crying in a treehouse or something.
Jeffrey had given up trying to teach this old dog even one new trick.
Need you to memorialize yesterday morning from the moment you got the call about Caterino to right now.
Frank didn't miss much.
Lawsuit?
Probably.
Sarah can tell them how hard it was to find a pulse. Who knows whether or not the girl was going in or out? That kind of injury? She could have flatlined a couple of times.
Frank topped off Jeffrey's mug before filling his own.
Makes me feel sorry for Sarah. The upside of divorcing you was she'd get to stop saving your sorry ass.
Jeffrey was not in the mood.
You gonna break my balls about that for the rest of my life?
I assume the natural order of things will have me keeling over well before you.
I think you mean natural selection,
Jeffrey said.
Are you telling me when you go to Biloxi every other month for your gambling trips, you're not getting your pecker wet?
Every other month is your take-home message. Pigs get fat. Hogs get slaughtered.
He raised his mug before taking his leave. Jeffrey threw the rest of his coffee down the sink. He was too jittery for more caffeine. In the squad room, he found Marla Sims, the station secretary, taking the dust cloth off her IBM Selectric. Jeffrey had bought her a computer, but as far as he knew, she had never turned it on. All of his missives were either written out in her perfect Palmer method or pecked onto the typewriter. Some of the younger cops cringed every time she fired at the machine. The ball punching into the paper sounded like a gunshot. The saloon door squeaked. Lena Adams was shifting her utility belt around her waist.
Lena, my office.
She looked up at him like the proverbial deer in the headlights. Jeffrey sat down at his desk. His eye caught the bookshelf, which was filled with textbooks and manuals, and worst of all, an old photograph of his mother.
Fuck me.
Sir?
Jeffrey waved off the subject. He had forgotten to call the florist yesterday. Now he was going to be dealing with a screaming phone call from his mother about missing her birthday.
Shut the door. Sit down.
Lena sat on the edge of her chair.
Is something wrong?
He could hear Sarah's nagging voice warning him that Lena always assumed she was in trouble because she had usually done something wrong.
Give me your notebook.
She reached for her chest pocket, then stopped.
Did I do?
Just give it to me.
The notebook Lena handed to him was just like every other notebook every other cop carried, because Jeffrey bought them by the hundreds and kept them readily available. Technically, that made them the property of the police department, but he hoped to God that technicality never had to be tested in a court of law. He flipped past the back pages that detailed last night's failed search for Leslie Truong. He could read about that in Lena's official statement. He found what he was looking for at the front of the notebook. Lena had crossed through Jane Doe and written Rebecca Caterino. She had not changed the original assessment, accidental death. Jeffrey checked that her notes matched what he had sworn to in her official statement. 558,
911 call received at HQ. 602. L.A. dispatched. 603. L.A. met witness Leslie Truong in field behind houses. 604. B.S. arrived, and with L.A. and Truong, located body. 608. L.A. verified victim deceased at neck and wrist. Body positioned as noted. 609. L.A. called Frank. 615. B.S. set up perimeter. 622. Frank arrived. 628. Chief on scene. He asked Lena,
Brad arrived when you were talking to Leslie Truong. Did he check for a pulse when you got to the body?
Lena had stopped being defensive. Now she was strategizing.
I don't remember.
Lena was a senior officer on scene. If she told Brad not to double-check behind her, then Brad would not have dared to double-check behind her.
Next time you run that bus over another cop, make sure you give it enough gas.
Lena looked down at the floor. Jeffrey studied the notebook. He had lied to Sarah about confirming the details yesterday. Each line of text took up one line on the page. The ink was the same color. Either Lena was incredibly prescient, or she had done exactly what she had told Jeffrey that she had done. He turned the page. Lena had drawn a rough diagram of the position of the body. She had noted that the clothes were in place. Nothing had looked disturbed or unusual. She had been very thorough, except for leaving out one thing. He asked,
Why did you turn off the iPod?
Lena looked trapped. He dropped the notebook on his desk.
You're not in trouble. I just want the truth.
She finally shrugged.
I don't know. I guess I was trying to do things right. But I did it kind of accidentally, like I have an iPod Shuffle I run with, and I don't charge it like I should, so the battery runs down and...
You did it out of habit, he said.
Lena nodded. Jeffrey sat back in the chair. He could think of a lot of things you did out of habit.
When you checked her neck and wrist for a pulse, do you remember if you straightened her clothes?
No, sir.
She was shaking her head before he finished the question.
I wouldn't do that. Her shirt was straight, like...
She put her hand to her hip.
One side was here, the other side was here, which is what you'd expect from somebody fallen.
What about her shorts?
They were pulled up to her waist, Lena said. Honest, I didn't touch her clothes.
Jeffrey stapled together his fingers.
Did you smell anything?
Like what?
Jeffrey became aware of a lot of different things at the same time. That Lena was a woman. That he was her boss. That the door was closed. That they were about to talk about uncomfortable things. But she was a cop, and they were both professionals, and he couldn't treat her any differently than he would any man in uniform.
How many sexual assaults have you worked?
Actual sexual assaults? She asked. You mean where the woman was really raped?
Jeffrey's headache started to throb again.
Go on.
None of them ever got past the paperwork stage. She shrugged. You know how students are. They're away from home for the first time. They drink too much. Start things they don't know how to stop. Then the next morning they remember the boyfriend back home, or they panic that their parents will find out.
If she was going to sound like Frank, then Jeffrey was going to talk to her like Frank.
Did she smell like she'd had sex?
Jeffrey forced himself not to look away, while a blush exploded up Lena's neck and into her face. He listed the possibilities.
Lubrication, condoms, semen, sweat, urine, a man's cologne.
No.
She cleared her throat. Then she cleared it again.
I mean, if anything, she smelled clean.
Clean how?
Like she'd just taken a shower.
Lena retrieved her notebook. She tucked it back into her pocket.
I guess that's weird, right? Because she took off from the college, and it wasn't really cold, but it sure wasn't hot. But she was at least a mile into her run, so why would she smell clean and not sweaty?
Tell me what clean smells like.
Lena thought about it.
I guess like soap.
Do you think she could have been sexually assaulted?
Lena shook her head immediately.
No way. I talked to my sister about her. Becky was a total nerd. She spent her nights at the library. She always sat at the front of the class.
Jeffrey wasn't pleased to hear his own words to Sarah come back at him.
Who she is doesn't matter. Our job is to find out what happened to her. I want you to pull all of the unsolved rape reports for the Tri-County area. Grant, Memminger, Bedford. Focus on anyone who was attacked in or near a wooded area, especially if they have physical characteristics that match Caterino's. Remember, rapists have a type. Also, I need you to make copies of your notebook, all the relevant pages, and keep this between us. Got it?
Lena looked like she wanted to argue, but she nodded.
Yes, sir.
I want to talk to your sister. See if she can get her to come by this morning.
Lena's mouth opened. Then it closed.
She's blind, my sister.
I can go to her house.
No!
Lena had shouted the word. The blush came back like wildfire.
Sorry, Chief. I'll call her now. She's probably on her way to class. She gets around on her own. She's fine. Just don't talk to her about personal stuff, because she's very private.
Jeffrey hadn't planned on delving into Sybil Adams's intimate details.
Let me know when she's here. Leave the door open.
Yes, sir.
Lena kept her head down as she walked back to her desk. Then, because his day hadn't started out bad enough, Jeffrey saw Sarah talking to Marla Sims over by the reception counter. Sarah looked up. She waved. He frowned. Sarah was undeterred. She left Marla. She stopped just outside his office doorway. Her briefcase dangled from her hand.
I apologize for the way I said what I said.
But not for what you actually said?
She gave a tight smile.
Yep.
Jeffrey waved her in. He caught a glimpse of the photograph of his mother and felt his headache pound up a notch. Sarah closed the door. She dropped her briefcase. She sat back in the chair.
Three things. One is the apology.
Was it really an apology?
Two is, Dr. Barney is finally retiring. I'm buying out the practice. We'll start telling patients next week. I'll probably need to hire another doctor. I thought you should know ahead of time.
Jeffrey wasn't surprised. Sarah had talked about taking over from Dr. Barney for years. Now that she wasn't helping Jeffrey pay off his student loans, she had plenty of money lying around.
Number three.
I spoke with Becky Caterino's surgeon this morning, all on the QT. He agreed to let me take a look at her films. I gave him your private email address.
Why didn't you give him yours?
Because I'm a doctor, and I am legally bound by HIPAA to protect patient privacy.
Did it occur to you that I'm a police officer, and I am legally bound to the Constitution of the United States?
She shrugged, because she knew that she had him exactly where she wanted him. He asked,
What did the surgeon say?
That the skull fracture looked unusual. He wouldn't go into detail. I tried to press him on the puncture in her spinal cord, but he wouldn't speculate. Or he didn't want to be called to the stand.
Jeffrey guessed he wasn't the only man who was afraid a lawsuit was going to damage his career.
I got a warning from Nick that the father is feeling litigious.
I don't blame him. His daughter's life has been irrevocably changed. She is going to need a lifetime of medical support. He can either go bankrupt trying to take care of her at home, or he'll have to turn her over to the state. You can imagine what that would look like.
Jeffrey thought about all of the time they had wasted standing around while Becky Caterino fought for her life.
Do you think 30 minutes would have made a difference for her?
Sarah's face took on a diplomatic expression. She was already exhibiting bradycardia and bradypnea when I knelt down beside her. Jeffrey waited. Her respiration and heart rate were dangerously low. He said,
I read your resuscitation notes. 3 minutes is a long time to go without oxygen.
Sarah could have crushed him right now. 3 minutes was a benchmark for serious brain injury. Jeffrey had looked up the information online, but she had learned it in medical school. Every second counts, was all that Sarah would say. Then she had the generosity to change the subject. Do me a favor, though. Brock doesn't know I'm making phone calls. He didn't make it to the body, let alone assess her, but I don't want him to think I'm stepping on his toes. Brock would have no problem with Sarah stepping on his neck.
Did you smell anything on Caterino?
You mean intercourse? Sarah had brought up the possibility the previous day, right before they had gotten into a one-sided screaming argument, so he wasn't surprised she'd given it some thought. If Rebecca was sexually assaulted, she was 30 minutes out. She was paralyzed, so she couldn't move. But her clothes were in place. There was no sign of a struggle, no signs of bruising or trauma from what I could see of her thighs. I didn't smell anything at all. But honestly, I wasn't going to stop and sniff her once we realized that she was still alive. He appreciated the we.
I asked Lena if she smelled.
Sarah barked a genuine laugh.
How did that go?
Fine. She's a professional, Sarah. You need to respect her.
Sarah looked around his office. She was giving herself space to back away from that line where they were at each other's throats again. He said,
Lena told me Caterino smelled clean, like soap.
Sarah chewed her bottom lip. Okay, let's walk ourselves through this. What would it mean if Rebecca Caterino was attacked? Jeffrey opened his desk drawer. He had no fear of the line. He tossed his calculator in her direction, in case she needed help counting up all of the fucks she didn't give. All Sarah said was, that's fair. The admission didn't make him feel any better.
It's been a year.
It has.
I want to know about your car.
It's a BMW Z4 with an inline six. He had already tortured himself with the details.
Your Honda was 4 years old. You just paid it off.
Sarah looked around the office again. When I bought the Honda, I was a cop's wife. And when I walked out of the house that day, I knew I wasn't going to be a cop's wife anymore.
What I did, it was a stupid mistake,
he told her.
It didn't mean anything.
Oh, wow, thank you so much. That changes everything. Jeffrey retrieved the calculator. He dropped it back in his desk drawer.
Rebecca Caterino, you go first.
Sarah leaned her head into her hand. He could tell she needed to do this as much as he did. She said, let's say Becky was attacked. That would mean that someone followed her through town, into the woods, then attacked her. Maybe he knocked her unconscious with a branch or a rock. She falls. He rapes her. Then, what are we saying? He took out a bar of soap and scrubbed her down?
What about those wipes for babies?
There are other wipes with disinfectant. You can get unscented, but they're still a scent. Sarah started to nod. She was seeing it now. If he used a condom, that would make it very likely he didn't leave sperm. And if she was unconscious, she wouldn't be fighting back, so we wouldn't find the typical defense wounds on his arms and face.
You said he would have followed her from the school. It was roughly 5 in the morning when she headed out for her run.
Sarah picked up on his line of thought. Which means he was waiting for her, watching her. But did she always run in the mornings? Jeffrey thought back through the reports he'd just read.
It wasn't normal, but it wasn't unusual. There was a fight with one of the roommates. They didn't say about what. Becky went for a run to cool down.
A visitor caught his eye through the window. Lena Adams was standing on the other side of the reception counter. She was wearing dark sunglasses and dressed in a pastel pink sweater, which was the only clue he needed to know that he was not looking at Lena Adams. Sarah had turned, too.
I volunteer with Sybil at the Girls in STEM Club at the high school.
What's she like?
You know how a mirror flips your reflection so that right is left and left is right?
Jeffrey got her meaning. He shook the mouse on his computer to wake it up. He logged into his Gmail account.
I've got to go talk to her. If you want, you can wait for the email here.
The offer earned him one raised eyebrow.
You're giving me access to your computer?
Why wouldn't I, Sarah? I've got nothing to hide.
He double-checked the account to make sure it was the one that Sarah knew about.
Do what you want. Wait here. Don't wait here. I don't care.
The squad room had started to fill as Jeffrey walked toward the reception counter. He pushed through the saloon doors.
Ms. Adams?
It's Dr. Adams, Marla told him,
her voice too loud for comfort, because she apparently assumed Sybil's blindness equated to some kind of deafness as well.
She was on her way to school when Lena called her to drop by.
Thank you, Marla.
Jeffrey offered his hand. Then he took it back. Hello? Sybil sounded like a softer, less intense version of her sister. Are you Chief Tolliver?
Yes.
Jeffrey felt like a certain kind of fool. His only way out was honesty.
I'm sorry, Dr. Adams. I'm not sure how to navigate this. How can I make you more comfortable?
She smiled radiantly.
It sounds awful loud in here. Do you mind walking outside?
Absolutely.
She used her cane to find the door. He held it open for her, saying,
Thank you for coming by. I know you're busy with spring break coming up.
This takes priority.
She tilted her chin up toward the sun. The rain had passed. There was a crisp breeze in the air. Her accent was softer than Lena's, but still pure South Georgia.
What can I tell you about Beck and Leslie?
I know the highlights. They were both good students. You taught both of them.
I had Becky this semester. She was supposed to meet me at 7 yesterday morning. I had given her the usual warning about wasting my time, but I was honestly surprised when she didn't show. She was generally hard-working and respectful.
What about Leslie?
The same. Hard-working, good attitude. She applied to the graduate program. I wrote her a letter of recommendation. She added, To be frank, I don't fraternize with undergrads. I'm close to their age. I'm trying for tenure. I don't want to be their friends. I'm their teacher. My job is to mentor them.
Jeffrey understood. As obstinate as Lena could be, he felt a tremendous reward any time he was able to drill something useful into her thick skull.
Do you know anything about Becky or Leslie's social lives? Maybe you saw them.
Sybil smiled, because she didn't see anything.
I hear quite a lot. Schools thrive on gossip. So I can tell you that Leslie was arguing with her roommates. I have one of them in my 3 o'clock intro to Cam, Joanna Gordon. She's been complaining about her living situation lately. Apparently, there's been some stealing going on.
Jeffrey remembered Benita Truong mentioning that her daughter had complained about some clothes and a headband that had gone missing. He was grateful that the voluminous number of student thefts were handled by campus security.
Would you say that Leslie was temperamental?
I gather you're asking if I think she ran off in a fit of pique?
Jeffrey frowned. But then he realized she couldn't see him frown.
That was some pretty tough going, what happened yesterday. I don't think many girls that age would be able to handle what she saw.
I don't think many boys would either. But would we be having this conversation if one had?
Jeffrey cringed, but she couldn't see that either.
I'm relying on facial expressions to smooth out the awkwardness.
She smiled.
I know.
Jeffrey looked up the street. He could see a group of students heading to class. He asked Sybil,
Is there anything that feels weird about this to you?
Do you think my loss of sight has sharpened my other senses?
No. I think you're a teacher. And having been a student for many years, I know that the one thing teachers are really good at is seeing through bullshit, and not with their eyes.
She smiled. You're right. I'll tell you why I don't think Leslie would run away. The work matters to her. She spent most of her life getting to this level. She's got deep roots at the school. She's in the band. She volunteers at the math lab. She has responsibilities. And I know that someone from the outside might think that all of these responsibilities are burdens, but that's not how Leslie looks at them. It's a very difficult thing being a woman in science. You must know this from Sarah.
I do.
You have to fight twice as hard for half the respect. And then you go to sleep and you wake up the next day and you have to fight the same battles all over again. Leslie was willing to do that. She knew what she was getting into. She relished the challenge.
Jeffrey kept his gaze on the end of the street. He didn't want to think about optics. But one missing student, another gravely injured, and a bunch of cops who stood around asking about hysterical young girls was not how he wanted his police force to be viewed. Sybil asked,
You know she's gay?
Jeffrey felt his eyebrows spring up.
Leslie?
No, Becky, Sybil explained. I heard her telling Kaylee about a Dear Jane email she'd received from her high school sweetheart. Becky sounded quite raw over it. Kaylee was urging her to get back out there. Becky said she wanted to concentrate on her schoolwork.
Jeffrey wasn't sure why Lena hadn't mentioned this detail in her report.
You're talking about her dorm mate, Kaylee Pierce?
That's right. Sybil confirmed. Between us, I think she was crushing on Kaylee. I noticed a change in the cadence of her voice. I'm not certain Kaylee felt the same way. It's hard at that age. Feelings are so intense.
Is Leslie true on gay?
She had a boyfriend, Sybil added. Of course, that doesn't mean much. This is still a very small town. And I work at a very conservative school.
Jeffrey felt the need to apologize on behalf of the town.
There are good people here, but you're right. We are not as welcoming to minorities as we should be.
Are you saying I'm a minority?
She put her hand to her face.
Oh, no.
Jeffrey took way too long to realize that she was kidding. Maybe because he was wondering if he was looking at a hate crime. Which he could have been thinking about a lot sooner if Lena Adams had done the same easy detective work as her sister and figured out that Rebecca Caterina was gay. He said,
Thank you, Dr. Adams. I really appreciate your dropping by to talk to me.
Oh, is that it? She asked. I assumed when Lee mentioned Leslie that you wanted to ask about Tommy.
Who's Tommy?
Thomasina Humphrey. Didn't Sarah tell you about her?
Jeffrey studied the woman's face. He detected no guile. She genuinely assumed that Jeffrey knew something that he did not know, and that Sarah should have told him.
Sybil seemed to sense his thoughts. I shouldn't have said. I'm sorry.
It's okay. If you could...
I should go. Good luck to you, Chief Tolliver. I'm sorry I wasn't more helpful.
Jeffrey stopped short of grabbing her arm. He watched Sybil Adams use her cane to find her way down the sidewalk. A student joined her, then another one. Soon she was one of a crowd. Jeffrey closed his eyes and tilted his face up to the sun, the same way Sybil had. He heard a truck drive by. The wind picked up, rustling through his hair. He racked his brain, searching for any report that had come across his desk with the name Thomasina Humphrey attached. Nothing. He walked back into the station. Sarah was still in his office. She had opened her laptop to work. His computer monitor was turned so she could see if an email came in. Jeffrey closed the door. He leaned his back against it, his hand still on the knob. He told Sarah,
Thomasina Humphrey.
She lifted up her chin, acknowledging the name.
Is there something you're not telling me?
Obviously. She seemed to want to leave it at that. Jeffrey looked back at the squad. Every chair had a butt in it. Half the patrol unit was loitering outside the briefing room, waiting for Jeffrey to start the day. He was not going to have another argument where he was the only hysterical idiot anybody could hear.
Sarah.
She took off her glasses. She closed her laptop. She turned in her chair to look at him. Sybil brought her to me about 5 months ago, at the end of October. Tommy didn't leave at the end of her morning class. She'd started bleeding. She made out like it was her period, but Sybil could tell something was wrong. She talked to her. It took a while, but Tommy admitted that she had been raped the night before. Jeffrey took a beat in order to keep his temper in check, because rape was a crime, and Sarah knew this, yet she hadn't reported anything to him.
Did she know her attacker?
No.
Did she report it?
No.
Did you tell her to?
Once, but she refused, and I didn't press her.
Because?
Because she was a good student. She was careful. She always had her nose in a book.
You really think now's the right time to throw those words back in my face?
No. But you need to listen to me about this, Jeffrey, because it explains a lot of things. Sarah stood up. She walked over to him. Do you remember that book you read to me? The one about Hiroshima? There was something so intimate about her tone that she was able to put him back in that exact moment. They were both lying in bed. He loved reading to her at night. Jeffrey was showing her some photographs from his book, reading out some of the more poignant lines. She said, You told me about the shadows. Do you remember that? He did. The heat from the atomic explosion was so intense that anything in its path burned a shadow into the walls or pavement behind it. A man walking with a cane. A person sitting on a set of stairs. Plants and bolts and machinery. They had all left permanent shadows that you could still see today. Sarah told him, That's what rape is like. It's a black shadow that burns through you. It alters your DNA. It follows you for the rest of your life.
How bad was it?
Very bad, Sarah said. I knew Tommy from before. She was one of my patients. That's why Sybil brought her to me. She thought I could help her.
Did you?
I sutured her. I gave her pain medication. I promised her I wouldn't tell anyone. That was her overriding fear that her father would find out the details, that her friends and teachers and everybody on campus would know. But did I help her? Sarah looked haunted by the question. You can't help anyone who goes through that. You can try to make them feel safe. You can listen to them. The only thing that you can really do is hope and pray that they find a way to help themselves.
I understand what you're saying,
he told her.
But why did Sybil bring up Tommy's name in relation to Leslie Truong?
I assume because the next day, Tommy disappeared from school. She left all of her things. She didn't come back. She didn't contact anyone. Her phone was disconnected. She was just gone.
Kevin Blake didn't.
Her parents withdrew her from class. I'm not sure what happened to her things.
But, Sybil.
You need to leave it alone.
Tommy Humphrey was the victim of a crime. From what you're saying, it was a serious crime. And now Leslie Truong is missing? Who knows what the hell happened to Becky Catarino? These are links, Sarah. We have to explore them.
Are you going to open up every rape investigation in town? How are you going to find the women who were too damaged or too afraid to report it? How are you going to locate girls who left the school because 15, 20, 30 minutes of their lives erased every meaningful second of the 2 decades that came before it? He seldom heard Sarah speak so passionately about something so raw. He'd always wondered about Tessa. She had spent a lot of drunken nights during high school and college. Jeffrey could vividly recall making a 5-hour drive to Florida in the middle of the night to talk the local sheriff out of charging her for drunk and disorderly. He chose his words carefully.
If there's a connection between what happened to Tommy Humphrey and what happened to Becky Catarino or Leslie Truong,
leave her alone, Jeff. Please. For me. He was so close to agreeing with her, if only because he wanted desperately to do something, anything, that made Sarah trust him again. Then his computer chimed, announcing a new email. Sarah went behind his desk. She put on her glasses. She did a couple of clicks. He could see the images reflected in the lenses. She said, "Come here." Jeffrey stood behind her. He guessed he was looking at a slide from an MRI. He recognized cervical vertebrae stacked down from the skull, but the cord running behind it resembled a piece of rope that had frayed at the middle. Fibers jutted out, something that looked like a liquid bubble encased the area. Sarah said, "This is a spinal cord puncture. Something sharp and pointed entered the skin here." Jeffrey felt Sarah's fingers press against the back of his neck. Her legs would be paralyzed, everything from here down. Her hand went to her hip. This injury was deliberate. It wouldn't happen from the fall. I would guess the instrument was similar in shape to an awl or a counterpunch, but don't quote me on that. Jeffrey held back his questions. Sarah was opening the next file, which was an X-ray. The skull fracture. She clicked in for a closer view. Jeffrey knew what an intact skull was supposed to look like. The fracture was at the back of the head, the spot where most men started to go bald. The bone had splintered into sun rays. A semicircular piece rested against the brain. Sarah knelt down, leaning in close to the monitor. "Here." Jeffrey leaned down beside her. He followed her finger as it traced a crescent shape at the bottom of the fracture. He knew that she wouldn't say definitively what had happened, so he asked,
"Best guess?"
"It's not a guess," Sarah told him. "She was hit in the back of the head with a hammer." Atlanta. Chapter 11. Sarah couldn't finish her second scotch. Her stomach felt sour. She was shaky in a way that was hard to articulate. Jeffrey's notes. Jeffrey's files. Jeffrey's field interview cards. Jeffrey's ruler straight lines drawn across a faded topographic map of Hartsdale. His ghost sat at the table across from her as she read his words from 8 years ago. The names came back with a startling clarity. Little Bit. Chuck Gaines. Thomasina Humphrey. The delicate script was such a sharp contrast to his tough exterior. Jeffrey had been the embodiment of tall, dark, and handsome. He'd had a football player's swagger, combined with a wonderfully sharp intelligence. Even in the precise technical jargon of a police report, the summation of a witness interview, the transcript of a phone call, his personality shone through. Sarah held one of Jeffrey's spiral-bound notebooks in her hand. It was roughly the size of an index card. He had put the dates on the cover, alongside the cases encapsulated inside. She flipped it open. Grant County was a small enough force that the chief of police doubled as an investigator. Every case that Jeffrey had worked on had made it into his notebooks. He had been a meticulous record keeper. Sarah paged through the headers in the first few dozen pages. Harold Niles, burglary. Jean Kessler, bike theft. Pete Wayne, stolen tips. $80,000. The dollar amount had its own page. Jeffrey had underlined it twice, then circled it. The writing had a dimensionality. The ballpoint pen point had left an indentation like Braille. Sarah thought about all of the things that could have backed up that $80,000. Not a burglary. Not a bike. Then she extrapolated the number to Jeffrey's life. His house had cost more than that. His student loans had been slightly less. His credit card balance, at least the last time she'd seen it, was around 5% of that number. Sarah smiled. There was only one thing that cost $80,000 from that time period, and that was Sarah's first Z4. She had absolutely bought the car to humiliate him. The miserable look on Jeffrey's face every time he saw the sports car had made Sarah feel more transcendent than any orgasm he had ever given her. And Jeffrey had been damn fucking good at giving her orgasms. Sarah turned the page. Rebecca Catarino, DOA. The DOA had been crossed out with a single line and amended to attempted murder / sexual assault. The tension between Jeffrey and Sarah had shifted during the Catarino-Truong cases. Sarah had found a way to be at peace with his refusal to tell the truth about how many women, how many times, he had cheated on her. As with many of her emotional shifts, the peace had come from her family. Sarah remembered a conversation with her mother the night after they had found Becky, before the assumed accident had turned into a full-on investigation. She was sitting at her parents' kitchen table. Her laptop was open. She was trying to update patient charts, but feeling so overwhelmed that she had finally given up and put her head on the table. Kathy had sat down beside her. She had grabbed Sarah's hands. Her mother's skin was calloused. She was a gardener, a volunteer, a handyman, and anything else that required her to roll up her sleeves and get to work. Sarah had been fighting tears. She was upset about the poor girl in the woods. She was furious at Lena. She was shaken because all of this tragedy had brought her into such close proximity with Jeffrey. And she was deeply ashamed of how she had volleyed insults with him inside her clinic office like a churlish ex-wife. "My precious child," her mother had said, "let me carry the burden of your hate. Let me do that for you so that you can move on." Sarah had joked about there being plenty of hate for Jeffrey to go around, but the mental image of her mother's strong back carrying the burden of Sarah's hate, her sorrow, her humiliation, her disappointment, and her love. Because that was the most difficult part, the fact that Sarah was still so much in love with Jeffrey, had somehow managed to lighten the weight that for the previous year had pressed down into every bone in her body. Sarah looked up from Jeffrey's notes. She took a sip of scotch. She wiped her eyes. She returned to the task at hand. Rebecca Catarino, DOA. Crossed out. Attempted murder / sexual assault. Jeffrey had documented arriving at the scene in the woods, discussing crowd control with Brad, getting the rundown from Lena. Like most cops, he used a shorthand, abbreviating Lena as LA, Frank as FW, and so on. He'd written a phone number in the margins. No name, just a number. Sarah's brain automatically went to the assumption that it belonged to a woman he'd been seeing. She sat back in the chair. She tried to clear the spark of jealousy that accompanied the thought. She turned the page. Talk to SL, 30 minutes. Jeffrey had been haunted by the 30 minutes that Becky Catarino had laid in the woods. Sarah felt haunted, too. 30 minutes was a long time. Half of the golden hour in which a patient's remaining lifespan was predicted by the actions that were taken to prolong her survival. Sarah had equivocated when Jeffrey had asked her if 30 minutes would have made a difference. Medically speaking, 30 seconds might have made a hell of a difference. The tragedy on top of the tragedy was that they would never know. Sarah looked down at the notebook. Beneath her initials, Jeffrey had written the name Thomasina Humphrey. Sarah combined the two details, and suddenly she found herself back in Jeffrey's office. She had been waiting for the email to be sent to his computer when Jeffrey had returned from his talk with Sybil Adams. Sarah had been so close to telling him about her own rape. She had wanted to protect Tommy from the pain of an interrogation. She had been certain that the girl's attack had nothing to do with Leslie Truong, and just as certain that it could not be linked to Becky Catarino. She had been wrong. She turned through the pages, searching for anything that could help them now. Brock was still the official coroner during that time period, so all of the lab reports and findings would be wherever he stored his files. Jeffrey had transcribed some of Sarah's observations into his notebook. But what had Sarah missed? What had Jeffrey missed? Was there a detail, a piece of forensics that they had been blind to, that they had ignored, that had allowed a violent, sadistic murderer to get away? Sarah was Jeffrey's widow. She had inherited his estate. It seemed she had also inherited the guilt. She heard a key scrape into the deadbolt on the front door. Sarah closed the notebook. She stacked together the files and crammed them back into the box. By the time Will entered the apartment, she was standing up, waiting for him. Sarah noticed a lot of things at the same time. That he had showered. That he had changed into jeans and a button-down shirt. That his expression looked strained. She swallowed down all of the sharp questions that churned up into her mouth. Where have you been? Why didn't you call? Why did you go to your house to shower before coming here? What the hell is going on? Sarah saw that Will was doing his own reconnaissance. His eyes moved around the room to her unfinished dinner, the bottle of scotch, the boxes of Jeffrey's things. She took a deep breath and let it go slowly, trying to avert what she was certain would be a disastrous blow-up. She told him, "Hey." Will knelt down. The dogs had rushed to meet him. Betty danced around his feet. Sarah's greyhounds pressed into his legs. The air felt heavy, like they were each drowning in their own separate pools of water. Sarah spotted a cut on the knuckle of his middle finger. Blood was weeping from the wound. She tried to joke. "Please tell me you got that from hitting Lena." He went to the refrigerator. He opened the door. He stared into the shelves. She couldn't deal with his silence right now. She asked him a question he'd have to answer. "How did it go?" Will took a deep breath similar to the one Sarah had taken. He said,
"Lena thinks you're trying to jam her up."
"I am," Sarah admitted. But she was galled that Lena thought all Sarah did was sit around and wait for opportunities to make her miserable. "What else?"
"I almost punched her in the face. Then I nearly pulled my gun on Jared. Then I beat up Faith's car. Oh, and before all this, I told Jared we were getting married."
Sarah felt her jaw set. The first part was obviously hyperbole. As for the last part, if this was some new backward way of Will asking her to marry him, it wasn't going to work. "Why did you tell Jared we're getting married?" Will opened the freezer. He looked inside. Sarah pivoted. "Did you have dinner?"
"I ate something at home."
She didn't like the way he'd said home. This was his home, the place that they shared together. "There's yogurt."
"You told me not to steal your yogurt."
Sarah couldn't take this anymore.
Jesus, Will, I'm not the Javert of Yoplait. If you're hungry, eat the yogurt.
I can have ice cream.
Ice cream isn't the same as yogurt. It has zero nutritional value.
He closed the freezer door. He turned around.
What?
She asked.
What is wrong with you?
I thought you put a moratorium on talking.
She wanted to kick him. It really sucks when the person you're supposed to be in a relationship with won't tell you what they're thinking.
So this is a teaching moment?
Sarah thought this was a moment where things could go really, really wrong. Let's just drop it.
Why didn't you text me?
I did text you.
She grabbed her phone. She showed him the screen. 3 times, and nothing, because I guess you turned off your phone. He rubbed his jaw with his fingers.
I can't take your grunts and long silences right now, Will. Can you just talk to me like a normal human being?
Anger flashed in his eyes. Anger was something Sarah could deal with. She had already picked a fight with her sister. She was furious about Lena. She was hurt that Faith had lied to her. She was heartbroken by the Jeffrey of it all. She was terrified that she had missed something in Grant County that let a madman get away, and she was desperate to make things right with the man she was going to marry, if he ever got his ass off his shoulders and